Are you ready for some football?
Hi, this is Dan Horn. Join Dave Lapham and me for every play of every game on the official home of the Bengals, ESPN 1530.
All right, there you go. There you go. Dan Horn, how about that? Ohio Sportscaster of the Year. Good afternoon. Hi, my name is Mo Egger. I will never be in the running for any such award. This is ESPN 1530. Thank you so much for listening. I am so happy that you're here. We have a short show today. Out of the way early for UK Hoops. Wildcats in Georgia tonight. The tip-off at 7 o'clock. The pregame starts at 5:30. So, early day for us. Early day for us. By the way, Taryn, you know how I drove you nuts in November and early December about how I hate it when it gets dark early. And you do the last, hour of the show, and sometimes around, December 18th and 19th, the last maybe hour and 15 minutes of the show, and you look outside, and it's pitch black. Last night, I'm driving home, get off the air at 6 o'clock. I'm in my car at, 6:10, and there's tiny little traces of daylight on the horizon. That made me feel happy. That made me feel happy. That put me in a good mood yesterday. That put me in a good mood last night. And it's continued through today. So now leaving early, there'll be even a little bit more daylight outside. It's still freezing. You still can't do anything outside. Frankly, you still really can't do anything inside either. But nonetheless, that made me happy. We have a lot to get to. Rick Boring is going to join us at 3:45. He joins us every single week to talk about Xavier basketball and NKU basketball, one of those two programs is actually playing right now. Another Xavier game has been postponed. The tilt for Tuesday night against Georgetown has been postponed. Another Bearcat game, by the way, has been postponed. The Saturday matchup against Houston has been shelved. And so these two programs are going to go a very long time without playing. We'll talk about Xavier and kind of the overall state of the college basketball season, where we stand right now with all sorts of games being postponed and how this is going to impact the NCAA tournament, and so much more with Rick coming up at 3:45. The conference championship games are this weekend. And I wanted to, by the end of this past season, look at the Cincinnati Bengals and feel like, you know what? They got their quarterback, and they got their coach. I'm one for two. I feel really, really good about Joe Burrow. In fact, I can't even talk myself into a Dan Orlovsky is wrong, and the Bengals should absolutely not even think about calling the Houston Texans regarding Deshaun Watson take. I can't even I can't do the mental gymnastics I need to get myself to the point that I could stick up for him and go, yeah, the Bengals should call the Texans. That's how much I'm all in on Joe Burrow. I think they got their guy. At the end of the season, we also wanted to feel like, you know what? The Cincinnati Bengals have their coach. I can't do it. Zach Taylor hasn't earned that. He hasn't earned it from me, and I'm guessing, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, that he hasn't earned it from you. Here's when he will have earned it from me. When there is something similar to what the Kansas City Chiefs are dealing with this week, in which they're getting ready to play in a conference championship game. Now, Patrick Mahomes has gone through parts of a practice today, but he remains in the NFL's concussion protocol. There seems to be a general feeling that he's going to be able to play on Sunday, which is great. Get a chance to watch Patrick Mahomes. Fantastic. But if he cannot go, and you root for the Kansas City Chiefs, don't you feel like the coaching staff, no matter who plays quarterback, no matter who the opponent is, no matter what other personnel issues your team might have, don't you feel like if you're a fan of the Kansas City Chiefs, like the coaching staff is going to give them a chance to win that game no matter what? That doesn't guarantee that they will. And certainly the Chiefs are in this position because of a loaded roster on offense, right? They got Tyreek Hill. They've got Travis Kelce. They've used their running backs pretty capably. Their offensive line at times can be problematic. Their defense is sort of hit or miss. They got a good roster. But they've also got a head coach and an offensive coordinator who have been together for years, have had a lot of success with each other in Kansas City. A head coach is going to be in the Hall of Fame one day, and an offensive coordinator that I think most followers of this league would like to see get a chance to be a head coach one day, just to see if he could actually do it, because we've been talking about Eric Bieniemy for so long. But if you're a fan of the Kansas City Chiefs, you certainly don't want to watch Chad Henne on Sunday. I'm not a fan of the Kansas City Chiefs, and I don't want to watch Chad Henne on Sunday. But if he has to play, don't you feel like, you know what? Our coaching staff is going to give us a chance. Maybe it's schematics. Maybe it's preparation. Maybe it's understanding how to bring out the most and the limited talent that your quarterback does have. You want to feel like, you know what? We'd rather have Patrick Mahomes. But as long as we have this head coach and this offensive coordinator, we're going to be okay. When it comes to the head coach of a football team, that's what I want. I want to feel like my coach gives me a decided advantage no matter what. No matter what else is happening around them. Now, it's worth pointing out, Zach Taylor at the end of the season won games with a third-string quarterback and a backup quarterback who was pretty short on experience. It's also worth mentioning, the Pittsburgh Steelers by the end of the year were a mess, not very good at all. Ben Roethlisberger's washed, and the Houston Texans are historically bad on defense. But that doesn't necessarily take away from what the Bengals have. The opponent the Kansas City Chiefs have on Sunday is obviously a lot more tough, right? A lot more formidable. It's a really good Buffalo team that has gone streaking into the postseason and backed it up with back-to-back wins over, obviously, because it's the playoffs, pretty good teams. Josh Allen has exceeded everybody's expectations for what they had for him when he was coming out of Wyoming. And my guess is, if you put a gun to my head and say, pick a winner, if Chad Henne is playing, I'm picking Buffalo. But if I'm a Chiefs fan, feel pretty good. You know what? We'd love to have Patrick Mahomes. Our coach gives us a chance. Two most important people for my money. We're going to spend months here talking about the offensive line. Penei Sewell, and who can they get in free agency? And can Joe Tooney be brought to Cincinnati? And How are they going to get better from the guys that they've had here for a while? Can Jonah Williams play himself into a role where you look at him and go, boy, he's playing like the 11th overall pick? Lots of stuff to be sorted out there. But the two most important people are the coach and the quarterback. I said this often 6-7 years ago when we were talking about the possibility of giving Andy Dalton the contract extension. Say what you want about the dollar figure. The Bengals are about to make Andy Dalton their franchise quarterback. Franchise quarterback is a constant in just a huge swirling series of changes that are going to be happening around him. Your quarterback is going to be a constant. He's going to be the guy that no matter what gives your team a chance. Sometimes you're going to have a bad offensive line. Sometimes your defense is going to be a mess. Sometimes your skill guys are going to be all injured. Sometimes the scheme isn't necessarily going to work. There's going to be all different stuff that changes during the life of a franchise quarterback's time in a certain town. But he gives you a shot every single season, and he gives you a shot every single year no matter what. I feel like Joe Burrow, for the duration of his time in Cincinnati, is going to give the Bengals a puncher's chance no matter what. We saw that. We saw that some of that this year, right? This was a bad offensive line. The skill guys were a work in progress. This team's defense was very much hit or miss, and that's being generous. They didn't have a decided advantage over anybody. Joe Mixon was injured early in the season. And over the first half of the year, the Bengals were in every single game, but really one. The Baltimore game, in which they were not ready for their blitz. But I think most of us view Joe Burrow as somebody who every single week, every single opponent, no matter what is happening around the team, as long as he is healthy, you're going to have a shot as long as you have him. I'd like to feel the same way one day about the head coach. That, to me, is why we talk so much about Zach Taylor. That's what I'm looking for. A guy that no matter what is happening, you know what? Because of who the coach is, this team is going to be ready. This team is going to be prepared. This team is going to be able to utilize its personnel. This team is going to be able to figure out a way to be competitive and usually more than competitive, even if it's got to use backups. Even if it's got to use a backup at the sport's most important position. We're not there yet. We're not there yet. By the way, Marvin Lewis almost achieved this. Marvin Lewis almost won a playoff game. We always talk about that 2015 playoff loss to the Steelers. It reverberates to this day. It's been 5 years. I'm tired of revisiting it. You wonder what the trajectory of his career is if he beats the Pittsburgh Steelers franchise's first playoff win in a quarter of a century with a backup quarterback, and I'm sorry, I still have to say this to some people, A.J. McCarron was never as good and is not as good as Andy Dalton. It almost happened with Marvin. And I don't think anybody would be stunned if it happened with Andy Reid. Hopefully Patrick Mahomes plays. But if you're a Kansas City Chiefs fan, I don't think you throw your hands up in the air and go, well, if Mahomes doesn't play, we have no shot. It certainly does help that your quarterback is going to have some dudes to throw to that a lot of backups would love to have. But you do have an advantage because you feel like no matter what, that coaching staff, that head coach, that offensive coordinator could figure out a way to win this game against this opponent with this backup quarterback. One day, the idea is to feel that way about the Cincinnati Bengals coaching staff. I think we all feel that way about the Cincinnati Bengals quarterback. At some point, you want to feel that way about the staff. And the fact that after two seasons, we're not there yet, I saw some really encouraging stuff late, I'll be the first to admit. But the fact that we're 2 years in, you certainly wouldn't say that he's at the level of Andy Reid, who's been a head coach in this league for more than two decades. Nobody's expecting that. What you are expecting at some point is to be able to look at your head coach and look at your coordinator, look at your coaching staff and go, you know what? They might not have their starting quarterback, but I'm not giving up on them. Because of the advantage they have in the sidelines. The Kansas City Chiefs have one on Sunday. 17 after 3. 513-749-1530 and 866-702-3776 are our phone numbers. At MoEgger1530 is how you hit me up on Twitter. You know, a lot of interesting and significant things happened during the 2020 Red season. One of the more significant things is something we haven't talked about all that much, and we need to apply it to the 2021 season. I'll explain next on ESPN 1530 Cincinnati Sports Station. In the podcast, we put old shows in the podcast page at ESPN1530.com. Oh, man. UK Hoops at 530, so we're done early. Hopefully we have Bearcat basketball and Xavier basketball soon. The postponements are mounting. By the way, it was kind of interesting over the weekend. So the Luis Castillo rumors kind of ran rampant, and I'm not really sure. They seem to kind of take on a life of their own on social media, which often happens. And you know, I frankly didn't spend a ton of time on social media over the weekend. Other stuff was going on, was watching football, just, I don't know, sometimes I take a break, largely took one over the weekend, but I did see the story Sunday night that Nick Kroll felt the need to address rumors by saying, look, we're not trading Luis Castillo, the rumors are false, we intend to have him on the team in 2021, which is certainly no guarantee that he's going to be on the team in 2021. He chose his words carefully. This part was interesting to me, and this is me doing something I try not to do, which is reacting to an overall vibe or mood on social media. Because I think sometimes in this business, you get too caught up in like reacting to a handful of people in what is largely an echo chamber. But it is interesting to me because I follow a lot of Reds fans and a lot of Reds bloggers. And the ones that I follow for a reason. I think they're smart. I think they're insightful. I think they're funny. I think they have something to add. I don't always agree, but you know, that's very much okay. So Luis Castillo, the Reds announced they're not trading him. And then, you know, a couple of other things trickle out that the Reds did talk to the Yankees, but the asking price for Luis Castillo was really high. High enough that it included Gleyber Torres. And the Yankees very quickly said, we're not doing that. The interesting part of that is, in the corners of the internet where I follow some Reds fans, or even saw folks tweet at me, there seemed to be jubilation. Now, I don't want the Reds to trade Luis Castillo. I want the Reds to build around Luis Castillo. I've got a guy with a great arm who's still ascending, still developing, who's one of the best pitchers in the National League, and he's under team control for 3 years. For my money, if you're trying to win, that's the kind of guy you build around. But where are we when the news comes down that they're going to keep a guy who's already on the team and whose contract was not up suddenly engenders a lot of goodwill and positive vibes towards the people who are making decisions in the organization. I mean, there was a lot of that on social media, man. Like, I say, hey, look, we're not trading Luis Castillo. See, we're good to go. We're going all in. Like, well, they already had Luis Castillo. We're going crazy over a team announcing that they're keeping a player they have already under team control for years and years and years and years. It's kind of interesting to me. Somebody who I think is always interesting whenever we talk about the Reds is Joey Votto. Before the show, Taren Bland said to me, you know, what's acceptable production for Joey Votto in 2021? And acceptable, that's, you know, that's a very narrow term. What's acceptable to me might not be acceptable to you. I would say this, that at this stage in his career where Joey Votto is no longer an elite offensive force, and I have no issue saying that whatsoever, and he's years removed from being an elite offensive force. If you had folks who, when Joey Votto was having MVP caliber seasons, if they didn't like him then, and you and I both know plenty of people who didn't like him then, they're most definitely not going to like him now, that he's an expensive player who's not productive. And let's be honest, if Joey Votto's name was not Joey Votto, and he was a random 37-year-old first baseman, and he was a free agent, and I said to you, the Reds should go get this guy, you would say to me, no thanks, I'm good, let's go find somebody else. Let's go find somebody who's in their prime. Here's the interesting thing I think about Joey Votto in 2021. Last year, David Bell benched Joey Votto for multiple games. Benched Joey Votto. The Reds were in Milwaukee. And David Bell benched him for a couple of games. Now, Joey, to a degree, responded to the benching. He hit better OPS after the benching last half of the season. 941. You saw some pop. Hit 8 homers. He got on base at not a typical Joey Votto clip, but still got on base about 39% of the time. Second half of the season, Joey Votto was really good. The second half of the season was limited to about 30 games. But the second half of the season, after the benching that last month, Joey hit better. He didn't hit great, but he hit better. You saw some pop. He was getting on base. He looked more comfortable at the plate. He was standing more upright. He was better. I don't know that you look at, and by the way, I don't think it's a coincidence, the Reds over those last 29 games after the benching went 17-12. The reality is Joey Votto is going to play, right? We all dealt with that last year. Like, all right, you could bench him for a while, but there's no real plan B at first base, and he is making $25 million, and they are going to defer to his track record, and so he's going to come back in the lineup, and he did, and he hit, and the team was better. What I want to know is, are they willing to take the next step if over a protracted amount of time, Joey Votto is continuing to struggle? That was a big, big moment for David Bell last year. And think of how often we talk about guys who have been really good for this team for a while, and it's always mentioned like, oh, you got to have the uncomfortable conversation. And remember when Brandon Phillips, who, you know, frankly, not the caliber of player Joey Votto was at his best, but still a guy, big part of this organization, had been here for years, all-star, part of winning teams, first ballot as far as I'm concerned, club Hall of Famer. Those last couple of years, you would often hear people talk about, well, the difficult conversation you're going to have about Brandon Phillips. It's a difficult conversation, moving him down in the batting order, or having him not play as much, or maybe he's only going to be a part-time guy, or perhaps he's going to platoon, and I'm going, difficult conversation, if this is difficult, what are you going to do when Joey Votto's old? Well, here we are. Joey will turn 38 before this coming season is over. And he is coming off of 3 pretty pedestrian seasons. And not just pedestrian seasons by his standards, but 3 pretty pedestrian seasons. You don't look at those numbers and you're not wowed by any of them. And again, yes, he was better in the second half of the year last year, but that was one good month that came at the tail end of a 2.5-year stretch where he frankly just wasn't that good. Wasn't that good. David Bell was willing to pull the plug on Joey Votto midway through the season, temporarily, but still, for more than just one game. This wasn't just a random day off. What I want to know is, A, if we get to the point of the season where Joey has played a sufficient number of games and the production is not there, Will David Bell be willing to take the next step, which is instead of benching him for a couple of games, he removes him from the starting lineup on a fairly regular basis and lets somebody else take his place? And then along with that, who then takes his place? What's plan B for your 37-year-old aging, declining first baseman, not being the player he was back in 2017? The further we put 2017 in the rearview mirror, the less likely it is that he ever produces at that level. This is not about the, you know, losing your mind over the money he's making. I think there's way too many people who focus on that. But the reality is, Joey wouldn't be starting every single day. He wouldn't be, you know, a furniture piece in the Reds batting order. He wouldn't be earmarked a starting spot if he wasn't making $25 million bucks. If this was a guy in the second year of a two-year deal paying him like $4 million, is Joey Votto starting 145 games this season? No, but we're going to plug him in for that. We're going to write that in pen. What I want to know is, though, if the production continues to drop, with the money being what it is in reality, are they going to be willing to pull the plug on something that for a large chunk of the last 2.5 years simply hasn't worked? In an ideal world, it works. In an ideal world, what we saw in the last month of the season from Joey Votto looks more like what we see this year, and he's on base at a high rate, and he's hitting well, and you see some pop, and the numbers look great, and this is not anything that we ever talk about. But we talked about it a lot last year, and more importantly, David Bell did something about it. You might say it was overdue. Some might even say it was premature. But it still made me wonder, okay, moving forward, what's plan B at first base? I still don't know, because the Reds have done nothing to make their team any better. But we have 3 more years of this. And the production is going in the opposite direction. Which leads me to believe that what we saw at the end of August last year, which was a removal of Joey Votto from the lineup for a couple of days, that's not going to be the last time that kind of thing happens. But the next time that it does happen, is it going to be for a couple of games? Or could it be for a longer stretch? Or could it be the beginning of a period of time in which Joey Votto is not playing every single day, where he's maybe coming off the bench once or twice a week, where he's getting regular rest against lefties, where he's getting regular rest in day games after night games, where he's getting regular rest in matchups that maybe don't favor him, where you're trying to get sort of a law of diminishing return thing here with Joey Votto playing less, but then maybe being able to do a little bit more? That's certainly not going to mesh with a lot of folks who just want to focus on the kind of money he's making. And I think there's a silly fixation on the kind of coin Joey makes. You have folks who at a given time can recite for you every cent that he's owed as of that date, but couldn't tell you what his on-base percentage is. Couldn't tell you what his batting average is. But I think it's a good question. Declining player. Last year you had to make the difficult decision to take him out of the starting lineup. You did it for a couple of days. The next time you do it, is it going to be just for a couple of days? And if we have gotten to the point where now it no longer makes sense for Joey to play every single day, and this dude's been a workhorse. 2015, 158 games. 2016, 158 games. 2017, 162. 18 and 19, 142 plus. Last year, played in 54 games. But aside from that stretch where he was benched, he was there every single day. Is it going to make sense to play Joey every single day? And that the answer is no. And he has to rest on a regular basis. And now we're talking about in a full season, there may be being, I don't know, 30 games, maybe a little bit more, maybe slightly less, where Joey's not the starting first baseman. Who is? 513-749-1530, 866-702-3776. 26 minutes away from 4 o'clock. This is Rick Boring, MusketeerReport.com, in about 10 minutes. On Xavier and NKU basketball and some other general college hoops questions, because I have a lot of questions about how the NCAA tournament is going to work. We'll do that in 10 minutes on ESPN 1530 Cincinnati Sports Station. Well, sports, the service of Kelsey Chevrolet. It's home of lifetime powertrain protection and guaranteed credit approval from their family to yours for life. Go to KelseyChev.com. From the 1991 Atlanta Falcons highlight reel. Too legit to quit. Let's see. UC in Houston on Saturday. I almost said UC in Buffalo. I'm not sure where that came from. UC in Houston on Saturday is no longer UC in Houston on Saturday. That game has been postponed. Chances are you know why. Xavier in Georgetown on Tuesday has been postponed. Also, chances are you know why. You know what, though? We have a college basketball game tonight on ESPN 1530, the reeling Kentucky Wildcats taking on Tom Crean's Georgia Bulldogs, who are not very good. I mean, they whacked UC, but they're not very good. They're going to play tonight, 7 o'clock, tip-off, pregame show at 5:30, right here, live on ESPN 1530. You know, I go back and forth. Rick Pitino said before the season that we should just move the season to the spring, the college basketball season to the spring. And like, as somebody, I'm not opposed to change. And if you are, God knows what's happened in sports over the last 10 months and really what's happened everywhere in all walks of life is probably been more disturbing for you or more difficult for you than most people. If you just hate change, if you just hate adaptation and evolution, the last 10 months have probably been more difficult for you than it has been for people who are not resistant to change. That said, there are certain things that you just sort of like to be able to set your watch by, and the college basketball season culminating with March Madness and playing out through the winter is one of those things. I didn't really have a hard take on what Rick Pitino wanted to do, and because of that, I admit that I really didn't flesh out, you know, pros and cons of starting the college basketball season later. But I am starting to wonder how much merit that idea had. And look, we knew there were going to be postponements. We knew there were going to be cancellations. And chances are we would have those things if we made college basketball this year a spring sport. So that certainly wouldn't have been a cure-all for all the problems this sport is having right now. But the way things are going at this moment where – I mean, you had Villanova last night, played for the first time in 27 days. St. Louis has yet to play a conference game. That's a good St. Louis team. We're going to be going on about a 2.5-week stretch between what was supposed to be Xavier's game on Tuesday and their most recent game, which was that thrilling buzzer-beating win over Providence at the Cintas Center a week ago Sunday. UC, God knows when they're going to play again. Their next scheduled game is Wednesday against Wichita State. It will have been forever since they've played. And just these long stretches without games in a sport, there's always such a great like cadence and rhythm to college basketball, specifically once you get into the conference part of the schedule, where for most schools there's, you know, a weeknight game and a weekend game. And depending on what league you're in, usually you can sort of set your watch by it. It's typically for most leagues, middle of the week. Obviously, with Big Monday, there's always games on Mondays, but there's a game during the week and a game on the weekend for most conferences. And there's kind of a rhythm to it. That rhythm has been completely disrupted. And I also wonder, just from an on-court product standpoint, I did watch Villanova last night, and you could tell as the game wore on, their legs were giving out a little bit, especially with all the threes they were shooting. But you just wonder how this is going to impact the on-court product as we get to the end of the year and get to March. Now, we could be dealing with the same thing if we had, you know, college basketball in the spring. Who knows about the availability of vaccines by then? Those are conversations that sort of loom larger than anything that we have here. But given the way this is playing out, and given the, I said on the show yesterday, there's just been, the air has been let out of the balloon when it comes to excitement over college hoops, which is a sport that I love. It just has. You just don't gather there's any sort of buzz. And I do think some of that is that a lot of the programs that are typically good aren't that great this year. Kentucky obviously being one of them. There are many, many others. But the way this is playing out, where there's the rug is being pulled out from underneath you almost every single day with games you look forward to, events you look forward to, the season has no rhythm to it, the gyms are empty. Maybe, I'll acknowledge maybe Rick was right. I don't know what to say definitively he was, but maybe he was. 17 away from 4 o'clock, 513-749-1530 and 866-702. 3776. By the way, our buddy Jason Fitz from ESPN and ESPN Radio is coming up at 4:20. I always look forward to chatting with him. You'll hear his show tomorrow night on ESPN 1530 because it's bumped for UK basketball. Let's talk with our buddy Rick Broering, MusketeerReport.com, color man on NKU radio broadcasts next on ESPN 1530, Cincinnati Sports Station. Warriors tomorrow. It's 13 away from 4. This is ESPN 1530. My name's Mo Egg. Rick Broering's here. His website that he oversees is MusketeerReport.com. He is on Twitter at Rick Broering. He is also the color analyst for NKU radio broadcast, working alongside Jim Kelch, and he joins us every single Wednesday. How's it going?
Doing well. How about you, Mo?
I am well. There was a part of me that thought about replaying last week's conversation, at least as it pertained to the Xavier Musketeers, because they haven't played a game since. I have no idea when they're going to play a game next, and I figured we could just run it back, but then I would have missed getting a chance to talk to you.
Well, I appreciate you having me on anyways, then. It's good to hear your voice.
It's nice to hear yours as well. Where does this thing stand right now? I'm asking you to guess what I think is the unguessable. When does your gut tell you this team's going to be back on the court?
I don't really see an opening until that next game that's scheduled now, which would be Friday, January 29th at Butler. Maybe the Big East has a situation where another team has a postponement, but they're fine. Right now, Xavier, first of all, has to get out of protocol. They're dealing with issues of their own. On top of that, it was just announced that Georgetown, who they're supposed to play on Tuesday, is dealing with COVID issues. So I think that's the issue. Like, not only does Xavier have to get healthy, but then you need another team who gets canceled at the exact right time that didn't have any COVID issues of their own. And I just don't know that that's a realistic scenario right now in this time that we're in.
All right, so there are the games that are on Xavier's schedule. And we can apply this conversation to a lot of schools around the country where the postponements have mounted. What is the expectation based on where we are right now? The games that have been postponed will be made up, and if the expectations to make up some of them, how many?
That's a great question. I think it's one that no one really has an answer to. I don't think the powers that be at the top of the conferences know that question. I think what they're doing right now is seeing, okay, how many games are we going to get in? And if we get to a point where it becomes problematic, meaning some teams that need 13 games that would be eligible for the NCAA tournament aren't going to get there, well, then maybe they'll start doing more. But until that happens, I think from a logistics standpoint and just from an overall health standpoint, it just doesn't seem worth it for them right now to bend over backwards to make some of these games up. And I don't really see much time built into the schedule at the end of the year or anything like that for them to do it either. So my hunch is that not many of these games are going to be made up, if any at all.
How are conference tournaments in the NCAA tournament going to happen with the way things have played out so far with the season's first 6-7 weeks?
I mean, did you not have, like, I don't know, the seven wonders of the world on the list for me to answer today? I really don't know, Mo. I mean, my hunch is that the conference tournaments, those are going to be more important than usual because there will be teams with uneven records and teams that don't have a great resume right now. So if you make a run through your conference tournament and you're a Big East team or an ACC team or a Big Ten team, that could be 3 or 4 really quality wins. And in a year where you don't have as big of a sample size to go off of potentially, those could be really important for your NCAA tournament resume. And then when we get to Selection Sunday and they're trying to decide, okay, how do we separate a mid-tier Big East team who barely played any non-conference games of consequence to a mid-tier SEC team that barely played any games of consequence and so forth and so on, how do you differentiate those? My guess is they're going to be relying on more heavily on KenPom and the other metrics that don't have as much to do with wins and losses.
The minimum threshold to qualify for the NCAA tournament, correct me if I'm wrong, is 13 games, right?
Correct.
So your Xavier right now, I think if the bracket were to be drawn up today, I think most of us would feel pretty good that they're going to get in. Right now they've played 12 games. We kind of dealt with this question during the college football season, you know, like with Ohio State. Well, why bother playing games? If they're not going to dock you for not playing, then don't put yourself at risk. What I don't like about that, though, is now, you know, all right, well, why play games? And I kind of view, I kind of have the same question about Xavier basketball. You've played 12 games. You've lost two. You have a tournament resume as of right now that's pretty good. Clearly, you got to get to 13. Chances are they are going to get on the court. But if you're them, why do you really want to make up some of these games if you're going to be pretty much safely in the tournament if you don't play those games?
Yeah, I think that is a legit concern. And let's face it, I mean, football is really different from basketball in the way that powers work and things like that. I don't think, I mean, especially this year when UK and Duke and a lot of the Blue Bloods aren't very good, Kansas, you can throw in that mix, you don't have those traditional powers who are probably going to get the benefit of the doubt. Maybe Gonzaga would, but they never really have that strong of a resume if you look at it because of the conference that they play in. So I don't think it's a situation where teams are sitting here with 12, 13, 14 games and are like, we have such a strong resume, we might as well just park the bus and not play the rest of the season because we're good to go. I don't see that happening. I think most teams are looking at it from a standpoint of, we want to get more games so we can get an extra quad one or quad two win or whatever to strengthen our resume. The real interesting thing comes in, do like teams start picking and choosing which games they're okay for or not. I'm not saying anybody would ever fake COVID protocol or anything like that, but if you've got, hey, we've got only one day of practice before we're supposed to get back before that game, well, if it's DePaul, Xavier might agree to be like, yeah, we'll be fine. If it's Villanova, it might say, hold on, wait a second, guys, we need a little bit of time to practice. It's not safe for our guys to go out and play this game yet. I could see some stuff like that happening, not specific to Xavier, but just for any team around the country, and I'll have an eye on that as we go forward.
So whether it's from a Xavier perspective or, you know, just your typical college basketball program in 2020, 2021 that's had to deal with postponements and putting the program on pause, how are coaches handling this? How are coaches handling having a thumb on their team when they can't practice, ensuring to whatever degree they can that they're in the kind of physical shape that players need to be, staying mentally focused? I mean, how are coaches navigating this?
Yeah, I think they're all kind of struggling with it. It's new for everyone. You know, it's new for the players, but it's also new for them, and they don't have all the answers right now in terms of what's the best situation. And quite honestly, I think a lot of times with what they're dealing with, there's no good answer. It just stinks. Like, you have to lock it up, close the gym, tell the guys to go home and be as smart as they can for 6 or 7 days or whatever it is until they come back for their next test. And I think that's kind of the situation we're dealing with, is just that there's not a lot you can do other than, you know, like Travis Steele has told us that he's tried to keep his guys engaged by if a different Big East team plays during the middle of the week and they're off or they're in quarantine, he has the guys do their own scouting reports from them. And then he sort of sorts through that with them and they come up with a game plan together. I think there's all types of little things like that coaches will do to reach out to their guys and try to keep them engaged. But in terms of like the actual basketball stuff and the stuff that matters and keeping your team ready to play, I don't know that you really can do anything about it. It's just a really tough circumstance.
I wondered this during the college football season, and I think we got it, where you have a team that's out of it. They're not playing for a conference championship. Maybe they're not even going to go to a bowl game. And, you know, guys who are really on board with, quote-unquote, doing the right thing and staying safe, they're a little bit less invested in those things, and they're going out where they shouldn't. They're putting themselves at greater risk of getting COVID-19. Do we wonder the same thing about college basketball as we get closer to the end of the season?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think I'd already be questioning that. You know, I mean, if you're a team who early in the season didn't play many games at all, and now you've lost a bunch of games to start when you did restart, and I'm not singling anybody out, DePaul, but just saying, like, if that's the situation you're in and your season is pretty much a wash already, if you're a college kid and you don't feel like there's a big risk to you, if you get this thing, do you think you're taking all the precautions? My guess is probably not. So I think that is definitely a concern for the sport. And the thing is, there's just, you know, it's a little bit different in terms of the practice. Like in football, you have your different position groups. You can keep those guys separated a little bit easier, or at least in terms of what they need to do for contact tracing protocol, they're able to say those guys didn't come in contact much. For basketball, you don't really have those situations. So, I mean, if one guy is doing the wrong thing and he gets it, well, everyone pretty much comes in contact with that one guy during practice. So that can really tank an entire team situation.
Acknowledging that A, hindsight is 2020, and B, COVID-19 is still going to be a part of our lives in the spring, has what's happened with the sport over the last couple of weeks caused Jude to revisit the suggestion that the sport should be a spring sport in 2021?
No, not at all. I don't really see how that helps much. I maybe don't know enough about the vaccine and how quickly it's being rolled out, but from what I understand, we're still going to be looking at this thing for
a while. Hang on a second. You're giving me a COVID-19 related opinion, and you're acknowledging that you're not an expert on vaccinations and epidemiology?
Yeah, I know. That's a rare thing in today's day and age, but it turns out I am not much of a doctor guy. I'm more of chicken wings and beer and basketball guy. And, I don't see any advantages to moving into the spring, to answer your question. I don't know that I have any real good logic or scientific explanation for that.
All right. NKU did lose both of those games against IUPUI. They were both pretty close. They lose the second of the two games by two. Now they've got to go to Robert Morris. I assume these games are going to play. Can the Norse get off the schneid against Robert Morris? And do you know what a schneid is?
Yeah, absolutely. You always want to get off the schneid. You never want to be on the schneid. That's never good. To answer your question, it's going to be tough. Robert Morris specifically, I think, is a difficult matchup because their best player, A.J. Brahma, who's a legit player of the year contender in the Horizon League, is a big guy. I mean, he's more of a forward. He's like 6'7", 215 pounds. But he can get inside. He really rebounds well. He can score with his back to the basket. He can face up and play. NKU doesn't have much in the way of post players, and they certainly don't have great post defenders. So A.J. Brahma is definitely a concern in this matchup. But look, all of the next four series for NKU are very winnable series. You got Robert Morris, UIC, Milwaukee, and Green Bay leading into that finale series against Wright State, who's a top 100 team in KenPom. All those other four teams I just mentioned are outside the top 200. So you would hope NKU can get back on the right side, but they're in a total rebuilding mode right now, so everything's up in the air, I would say.
All right, well, we'll do it again next week. Hopefully there's more games to talk about. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Mo.
That's our guy, Rick Broering, MusketeerReport.com. He is on Twitter, @RickBroering. He also is part of the NKU radio broadcast. The Norse will be taking on Robert Morris on Friday night. That game tips off at 7, pregame at 6:30. And then the next day, a late afternoon affair. Remember, their series, they play back-to-back, same opponents. So NKU and Robert Morris, those are road games for the Norse, Friday and Saturday. The Saturday game tips off at 5 o'clock. Our guy Jason Fitz from ESPN Radio is coming up at 4:20. I have a question about what we value when it comes to quarterbacks in the NFL. We'll do that coming up at 10 after. It's almost 4 o'clock on ESPN 1530, Cincinnati Sports Station.
No one covers the Bengals like ESPN 1530, Cincinnati's sports station.
Hey. Oh, wow, we're doing this again, huh? All right, good afternoon. I'm Mo Egger. This is ESPN 1530. Thanks so much. We're glad you're here. There's a reason why typically your bumper music doesn't have lyrics on it. We're breaking the mold here when it comes to that. I'm glad we're doing that. Jason Fitz from ESPN and ESPN Radio is coming up in just about 15 minutes. Philip Rivers retired from the NFL today from the Indianapolis Colts after one pretty good year, great career. I think I would put Philip Rivers in the Hall of Fame. Statistically superior to two peers that he's always measured up against, Roethlisberger and Eli Manning. The difference obviously being the fact that those guys have rings. I think Philip Rivers is interesting because he doesn't have a ring, and there's just not in the Super Bowl era a very lengthy list of QBs who have made it to camp without playing in a Super Bowl. They do exist. Warren Moon, Dan Fouts. Warren Moon won championships in Canada, but those guys didn't play in Super Bowls. Philip Rivers didn't either. I still feel like when you look at him statistically, there's going to be enough there, and it's going to be interesting when he goes in. There's the ballot, I think, is going to be pretty crowded by then. If Drew Brees retires, he's going to go in with Drew Brees, which is, you know, those guys are always going to be connected to each other because of Drew's time in San Diego. But Philip Rivers retires, and the bigger thing for me is yet another team, the Colts, who has a question now at quarterback. And you could do drop a pretty lengthy list of teams that should at least be examining their current quarterback situation. The Indianapolis Colts would be on that list. if Drew Brees retires, the New Orleans Saints, I don't think they would just automatically turn it over to some combination of Taysom Hill, Jameis Winston. The New Orleans Saints would be on that list. And then you kind of look around the league. Teams that are trying to figure out what they're going to do next at quarterback or definitively have a huge gaping hole at QB and they need to get a guy ASAP. The Jacksonville Jaguars, the New England Patriots, the Washington football team, the Jets. You add to it. Let's see. There's quarterback uncertainty with the Pittsburgh Steelers right now. There's quarterback uncertainty with the Chicago Bears right now. There's quarterback uncertainty with the Carolina Panthers right now. I think you would put the Denver Broncos on that list. The Atlanta Falcons, new GM there, are they going to start to think about life beyond Matt Ryan? Are the Detroit Lions, new front office, new coach, are they going to start to think about life beyond Matthew Stafford? Sean McVay and Jared Goff don't exactly seem to be on the same page. The Philadelphia Eagles, there's a lot of quarterbacks on that roster. Who knows what the incoming regime, how it's going to feel about Carson Wentz or Jalen Hurts. That quarterback situation is at least a little bit up in the air. You could say the same thing perhaps about the New York Giants. You could say the same thing perhaps about the Miami Dolphins. You certainly could say the same thing about the Houston Texans, based on what Deshaun Watson compels them to do. Now, some of those teams are going to stick with the guy they have. Some of those teams are on steadier ground than others. But I just listed pretty much half the league that has to be at least examining where it is at QB right now. Not to mention, John Harbaugh said today, the Ravens are going to throw a bunch of money at Lamar Jackson, and on many levels, I could understand why, but aren't you at least talking about how much money you're really going to be willing to give that guy, given some of the limitations that we've seen from him throwing the football? So like half of this league right now is dealing with a sufficient question about their current quarterback situation. And again, in some of those situations, maybe they proceed with what they have. Perhaps the Jets decide to give it one more go with Robert Saleh as the head coach with Matt Darnold. Sam Darnold. I call him Matt Darnold. Sam Darnold. I know a guy named Matt Darnold. Sam Darnold. It's not like he said tram in my head. Sam Darnold. Maybe the Saints decide that Taysom Hill, they're going to turn things over to him. Maybe the Colts make Jacoby Brissett the guy. But I don't think it would surprise anybody if most of the teams that I mention, if we find out that each of them gave a good, hard look at their QB situation and decided either for the short term or the short-ish term to start looking in another direction. Meanwhile, you've got a draft where I think we would all be surprised if by the time the fifth pick came off the board, we would be surprised if there weren't two quarterbacks taken, right? So Trevor Lawrence is going to go number one overall in all likelihood, and then, you know, Justin Fields. But there are some other quarterbacks who could perhaps enter the top 10. There's a kid from North Dakota State, Trey Lance. Didn't play a ton of college football and only played at the FCS level, but there's a lot of people that really like him. Mac Jones is polarizing. Zach Wilson from BYU, there's a lot of people that like him more than Justin Fields. I don't think it's far-fetched to suggest that five QBs could be given top 10 grades by one team or another. Maybe that doesn't happen, but in a league where there's a lot of teams either desperate for or interested in quarterbacks, that just moves a lot of guys up the list. It's interesting, 2 years ago when the Bengals drafted Jonah Williams, I remember doing the draft show that night, and we were looking at like the top eight, and you're going, you know what? In every single one of those instances, those teams can be pretty happy with what they have at QB. And I don't know that you would say the same thing about this year's top eight, nine, 10 teams. But you would most definitely say it about the Cincinnati Bengals. I think we would all agree the Bengals pretty comfortable now. You know, we'll see about Joe Burrow's health, but pretty comfortable with their current quarterback situation. So as here's what I would want to know, and this is kind of unanswerable right now, and as the guy who's always preaching open-mindedness, it's the kind of thing that I would certainly be open-minded about. The Bengals are sitting there at 5. Hopefully free agency is productive. Most of us want to see the Bengals nail it on the offensive line by acquiring more than one player. And by the way, I think the interesting thing about free agency in the NFL this year is less the pool of players who are, you know, free agents right now, whose contracts are about to expire, and more this wave of guys who get cut because of their salary cap number in a year where the cap is about to come down. So this could be this huge slew of guys that are available that we're not even really talking about. But yes, the Bengals, they got to nail it in free agency. Let's say they accomplish their goal, which it has to be fix the offensive line. And maybe it's overpaying for a tackle, and maybe it's finding somebody in that second or third tier at guard or whatever combination. I think most of us expect the Bengals to be active in free agency on the offensive line. What that is going to mean in terms of who and how much and how many, that remains to be seen. But I think it would be fascinating, given the current state of the league. I just mentioned, I don't know how many damn teams that are going to be looking at their quarterback situations or should be looking at their quarterback situations. How many of those teams would reach out to the Bengals for the 5th overall pick? Perhaps to reach and take a QB that ordinarily wouldn't be worth a top 5 pick, but given the fact that like half of the league right now has to be looking at their quarterback situation. By the way, I didn't even mention the Tampa Bay Buccaneers right now do have a quarterback who's 43 years old. He's playing in his 14th conference championship game, but he is 43 years old. So add them to the list. Maybe not for 2021. The obvious question is this. Would you be open to talking to teams about what they would be willing to give you for the 5th overall pick if one of them was interested in a quarterback that they could get at 5? And the answer to that question is, of course, when you're the Bengals, you should be open-minded about everything, especially early in the process, right? What I would want to know, though, is given the volume of teams that have to be looking at their quarterback situation long-term, could you create a bit of a bidding war for the 5th overall pick? Now, again, you might be looking at somebody like the kid from North Dakota State, Trey Lance, and go, look, I'm not taking that guy with the 5th overall pick. And maybe you shouldn't. And maybe he's still there at like 15 or 20 or something, and you don't have to trade up. But again, there's sort of a kind of a supply and demand thing here. There's only maybe 5. If we say that Mac Jones would possibly go somewhere in the first round, 5, maybe 6 quarterbacks and a number of teams, more than 6, that need one. Supply and demand can create a bidding war. Bengals don't need a quarterback. They have the 5th overall pick. Could you be reaching to take one of those guys with the 5th overall pick? Yes. But teams will do almost anything to be better at quarterback. Teams will do almost anything to be solid, set, stable at quarterback. The money you're going to see for some QBs who aren't close to as good as some of the best in the league is going to be an illustration of that. The Cleveland Browns took the ball out of Baker Mayfield's hands this season. Baker Mayfield only threw about 80 more passes than Joe Burrow. And he played a full season and Joe didn't. They took the ball out of his hands. And yet, I'm willing to bet they still give him an enormous amount of money. Why? Because there is a degree of stability that he gives them. And to Baker's credit, I thought he played pretty well in both playoff games. Not great against Kansas City, but pretty well. So that's what I wonder. And I don't have the answer to this from a fan perspective is, and even from a front office perspective is, yes, the Bengals should be open to everything right now. And you open yourself up to possibilities if you take advantage of free agency, if you make your team better before the draft. This isn't trade out of the first round. It's double up on picks. It's accumulate assets. It's build draft capital. Things that the Bengals, frankly, typically don't do unless it's later rounds when they get compensatory picks. Sitting there at 5, a high volume of teams, like half the league right now, has to be doing a deep dive, a thorough examination of their quarterback situation moving forward. I mean, like, it's a thing in Miami. I listened to Miami Sports Talk Radio last week, like 45 minutes. They're ready to move on from Tua Tagovailoa. I mean, like, think about that. This dude, you know, 18 months ago, everybody wanted a tank for the guy, including Dolphins fans. Guys played less than a full season, 8 or 9 games, ready to move on. They should take a good hard look. The Bengals, barring some you know, sort of unforeseen thing with Joe Burrow's knee, don't have to do that. You're sitting there with the five. I'm less interested in – I don't think Mac Jones is a first-round guy or a top-five guy. Doesn't matter. If someone there does, or if someone's so desperate to get a QB in this year's draft that they're willing to overpay to be able to get one who merely gives them some stability – or they think the guy's going to go midway through round one and they're picking later in round one, or they want to ensure that they can get one of these guys, I think it would be fascinating to see what the Bengals could be offered. And then if you took care of business in free agency, that's when you can really open yourself up to some possibilities. Because, by the way, as much as you could sign me up for Ja'Marr Chase, you could sign me up for Devontae Smith, I'd take either one of those guys. The early returns on this draft class is pretty good at wide receiver. And I keep coming back to this. The Bengals right now, the top two guys at that position on the depth chart, both second-round picks. I've done the whole thing before where we slobber over first-round picks at wide receiver, and then it turns out that there's some quite capable ones later. By the way, I've also seen the Bengals nail it with a first-round wide receiver, A.J. Green, and it helps turn around their franchise. But that, to me, is the really interesting part. You look around this league, whether it's quarterbacks retiring, quarterbacks getting old but not retiring, quarterbacks maybe not being guys that don't make a lot of sense to pay, quarterbacks that are just, it's time to move on, new coaching regimes, new front offices, there is a lengthy list of teams that are going into this draft, I'm sure, thinking, what do we do next to QB? What could that mean for the Bengals at number five? I don't have the answer to that. And I don't think you have the answer to that. In fact, I don't think anybody has an answer to that. But that, to me, is where the draft really gets interesting. Yes, at five, you're going to be able to get a player who should be able to step in and help you out right now. And yes, they should be open to Penei Sewell, any possible solution on the offensive line who's there at five and deserving of being picked that early and clearly at wide receiver. But things you can do in the draft to your entire team because of an accumulation of draft assets? The answer to that question is yes. How do you best go down that road? You move the fifth pick for a team that needs a quarterback. And right now, look around this league, close to half of the NFL does. 19 after 4, Jason Fitz, ESPN Radio next. Weeknights 7 and 9 on ESPN Radio. Spain and Fitz, we carry that show. One half of that show is Jason Fitz, who's on 1,000 different ESPN and ESPN Plus and ESPN digital platforms, and he's with us every single Wednesday, which I'm sure is the highlight of his week. How you doing?
Man, I'm good, my friend. It is a highlight getting to hang out with you every week. Come on now.
It is a highlight. I'm not sure it's the highlight.
I mean, you know, my wife's not listening right now, so we'll go with that. The highlight.
Very, very good. Very, very good. I like it. We spent so much time talking about the college football season, you and I, going back to late November, me complaining about the playoff rankings, you supplementing my complaints about the playoff rankings with actual logic that I think we've almost virtually ignored in this town, the conversations between you and I, the NFL. And so now maybe we could focus on that a little.
Well, you know, it's a magical time to get to reset and talk about the final four teams that we have left, Mo. So you're right. We've spent a lot of time on college football, but I think rightfully so because it was an entertaining product this year. And now we've got four teams left, and it's at least compelling. We got good matchups.
We got good matchups, and I'm going to localize it because that's what I'm supposed to do here. I watched Lamar Jackson this weekend, and look, he needs help. He needs guys who can get up and downfield. I watched the Browns and Baker Mayfield. Great story. Compelling game against the Kansas City Chiefs. Thought Baker Mayfield played okay. I watched Ben Roethlisberger in the postseason. He's washed up. You and I have talked a lot about Joe Burrow. As a Bengals fan, the rest of the roster has got to be fixed. In the AFC North, I believe the Cincinnati Bengals have the best quarterback situation in the division. Talk me out of that.
That's a tough one to talk you out of. I mean, Lamar's got an MVP, so I'm not going to take anything away from that.
Sure.
But at some point, Harbaugh and the Ravens are going to have to decide that they want to actually develop something around him that asks them to do more, because I think he is capable of more. There's a limitation to the way that offense is designed and to what they're allowing Lamar to do in general. Now, is that a limitation in coaching or limitation in playing, I don't know yet. I don't think any of us realistically know. So I'm not going to say that the book on Lamar says that he can't be elite, obviously, but Baker's pretty good. And, like, there's nothing wrong with that. Like, we're so worried about making Baker great. Like, the reality of it is he's an upper half of the league quarterback when he plays well. He's sort of that tweener quarterback. Like, it's not great enough that you're going to look at it and say, well, he's the next Aaron Rodgers, but most quarterbacks aren't. So Baker's pretty good. I think Joe Burrow, in 3 years, I think clearly Joe Burrow will be stand head and shoulders above everybody else. And I think, frankly, if which teams are built to be the best in the next several years, well, the Bengals have some things they need to address, for sure. But I don't see any reason why the Bengals can't look around and say, well, we have a quarterback that they can make us a contender to win the division for the next 5 years. Like, that's there. Now they've got to find some way to give him some semblance of an offensive line.
Yeah, no, you're right about that. And there's going to be opportunities to do that in free agency. There's going to be opportunities to do that in the draft as well. The storylines this weekend, and look, Patrick Mahomes went through a full practice today, full participant. He's still in the league's concussion protocol, but things are trending in the right direction for getting him on the field on Sunday. Beyond the obvious, which I think for a lot of folks, obviously Brady v. Rodgers and Patrick Mahomes versus Josh Allen, beyond that, do a deeper dive. What are the most compelling things about these games this weekend?
Well, I mean, you know, you got to look at the turnovers, right? Like, everybody talks about Rodgers versus Brady. It's not Rodgers versus Brady. It's the efficiency of the offense. Matt LaFleur, what he's done bringing the Titans offense over to Green Bay, is they built an offense that doesn't take a lot of negative plays and doesn't turn the football over. So, you know, lost in this quarterback conversation is the fact that Brady and the offense for the Buccaneers wasn't really that incredible last week. So they're going to have to be able to score long drives. They're going to have to put that together. That hasn't been able to be done against the Green Bay defense, and I think, frankly, is better than it gets a lot of credit for being. So I think Green Bay is going to run away with the NFC Championship game, not because Aaron Rodgers necessarily, but because they don't make a lot of mistakes. They don't commit a lot of penalties. They don't take a lot of negative plays, and they don't turn the ball over. So you're not going to get them to step on themselves. Game in Lambeau, I'll take Green Bay for that reason all day. On the other side of it, I wish that there was one more weapon other than just Stephon Diggs for the Bills. The Bills can score a lot of points. We all know that. But at the same time, the Ravens held them to 17, right? And so there is the opportunity for this Chiefs defense, which can get after the quarterback and does play sort of a structured defense that won't allow whoever's at quarterback to run around as much. I think the Bills defense deserves a lot more credit than this. The problem is, can you score enough points to beat Mahomes if he's playing in the Chiefs? That's tough to do when you've only got one guy. They're going to do a better job of taking Diggs away than I think people give the Chiefs credit for. So I think the game's a little lower scoring than a lot of people think, but I still think Kansas City rises above.
What did you make of fourth and one having Chad Henne roll out and throw?
I mean, that's the sort of call that if your favorite team makes it, you're yelling at your coach that he's a moron until it works perfectly. And then, you know, that's what comes with security. And you don't beat the Chiefs just by beating Mahomes. You got to beat Andy Reid. And he's a coach that right now he's coaching with comfortable security. And that's such a difference. And that's why, you know, I'm such a big fan of long-term coaching contracts, not because I want bad coaches to be held for a long time, but I think sometimes we get coaches that are constantly worried about what they're going to do because it'll affect their job status for next year. Andy Reid is coaching like a guy that doesn't give a darn what anybody thinks, how anyone's going to react, or what it means. He believes in his guys and his play call, and that's what he did. It was a brazen call, and not only that, lost in the minutia. They snapped the ball earlier than they needed to. I really think everything about that was perfectly executed. And it was not a Henny moment. It was a reminder that Andy Reid in this iteration is a better coach than he ever was in Philadelphia. And he's, I think, at this point, the best coach in the NFL.
I can't argue with that. I'll be listening tonight, my friend. Thanks so much.
Always appreciate you, brother.
You got it. Jason Fitz, one half of Spain and Fitz on ESPN Radio every weeknight from 7 to 9 o'clock. We have an hour to go. 513-749-1530 and 866-702-3776 at Mo Egger 1530 is how you hit me up on Twitter. The Reds are kind of just like everybody else. We'll explain next. ESPN 1530, Cincinnati Sports Station. Just not anytime soon. Sports update, a service of Kelsey Chevrolet, home of lifetime powertrain protection and guaranteed credit approval from their family to yours for life. Go to KelseyChev.com. College basketball tonight on ESPN 1530. The Kentucky Wildhats the Kentucky Wildcats need to start accumulating wins, and I need to figure out how to say their name correctly. Wildcats does roll off the tongue quite easily, and still I screwed it up. Tonight, John Calipari's club is taking on Tom Crean's team, the Georgia Bulldogs, if you were wondering, and chances are if you care, you weren't. This game is going to be in Athens. It tips off at 7. You'll hear it live on ESPN 1530. Pre-game coverage starts at 5:30. Wildcats trying to break a two-game losing skid after falling over the weekend to Auburn on the road. Kentucky is just 4-8. Still kind of, sort of, in the race for... They're not catching Alabama in the SEC. That's one of the most impressive performances I've ever seen from a college team shooting the basketball from behind the arc last night against LSU. But there's a lot of teams right behind Alabama who's undefeated in the SEC, sitting there with two losses. Kentucky is one of them. The games between UC and Houston and Xavier and Georgetown that were scheduled for Saturday and next Tuesday, respectively, have been postponed due to COVID-19, and Philip Rivers has retired from the NFL after 17 seasons. He guided the Indianapolis Colts to the playoffs this year, where they lost to the Buffalo Bills. I don't know why I threw that in the local sports headlines, but it's an NFL quarterback. It's a big retirement, and a guy who may or may not be in the Hall of Fame. My guess is he will be. So there you go. Philip Rivers has just chosen to hang it up and spend time. He wants to go coach high school football. So good for him, I guess. I don't know. Let's see. 23 from 5. Bob is calling from Florence. Hello, Bob.
Hey, Mo. What's going on?
I'm sitting here doing a talk show. How about yourself?
I'm not. But what I did want to ask you about, and I'm more curious about this, and I know typically what happens when you get a good quarterback on a great team sometimes the thing is he's got the best guys to throw to.
Yeah.
And I'm curious because what I saw, and I didn't see a ton this last year of Mac Jones, but I thought he looked horribly good. I'm sorry, that's not a good terminology. I thought he looked awfully good to me in terms of being able to throw the ball and throw the ball on target. And I know size-wise, he's a big guy. So
yeah.
Why is he kind of – down the dial a little bit from some of those other guys?
I think people just like Trevor Lawrence and Justin Fields a lot more. What I saw, and look, I'm not an evaluator of talent. What I saw from watching him was that guy could play in the NFL. There's just a belief that Trevor Lawrence and Justin Fields are better. I mean, like, you know, you can peruse the internet and you can find folks who really crunch this stuff, who say that there's shortcomings in terms of what he can do, right? So, you know, he was extraordinarily accurate. There's people who look at the fact that he only made a handful of throws from outside the pocket. I think the number was around 11%. Passes made outside the pocket, and go, look, he really hasn't shown an ability to make throws on the run, to make the variety of throws you have to make throws under duress. You know, for instance, with Joe Burrow last year coming out of LSU, the people were impressed by the way he was able to throw outside the pocket with Mac Jones. He wasn't asked to do that often this year, in large part because, you know, he played in a system that protected him. For comparison, by the way, Justin Fields threw 21.5% of his passes outside the pocket. So he was on the run a little bit more. He was under duress a little bit more. He was asked to do more things. Mac Jones wasn't asked to do necessarily as much. Now, does that mean that he can't, you know, be a successful quarterback in the NFL? Of course it doesn't. This is a guy who completed around 78% of his passes. He was remarkably accurate. He didn't take sacks. He didn't throw picks. But there are a lot of people who study this closely who have him just a rung below the guys that we kind of talk about as the clear-cut top two quarterbacks in this draft, and then you add the kid from BYU, and right now it seems like there's three guys listed ahead of Mac Jones instead of just two.
Does it hurt him at all, maybe the fact of Alabama quarterbacks in the NFL, with the exception of Joe Namath and possibly down the road Tua? Does it hurt him the fact that those guys haven't been overly successful?
Yeah, but then why wouldn't you hold that against Justin Fields?
Good point. Yeah.
I would like to now look, you could say you know, it's Ryan Day is the head coach. You could say that there is a lengthier list of Nick Saban QBs not necessarily panning out in the NFL than, you know, Ryan Day slash Urban Meyer quarterbacks. But I mean, if I would like to think that you're not going, that a personnel person would not bypass the chance to draft a player simply because other players at that school haven't panned out. If you like the guy, if you like him as a prospect, I would like to think that you're not going to refrain from taking him because of where he went to school and the lack of high-end QBs that went to that school. It's hard to produce really good NFL quarterbacks. There's only so many of them. So if you like a guy, if you like a prospect, I will ignore the track record of other QBs from that school that you went to. They may not just have been as good. They may not have been in the right situations. They may not have been. Look, A.J. McCarron's a guy that we had here, right? A.J. McCarron was not regarded as an elite prospect. Even if he had no injury issues, he wouldn't have gone in the first round. People didn't have a first-round grade on him. They thought he was like a third-rounder, fourth-rounder. He had an arm issue. He fell to the fifth round. Mac Jones is not going to fall there. He is regarded as a better prospect, a better player, better set of tools. I would like to think that you're not going to hold, I'm just using him as an example, AJ McCarron's lack of tools against the guy who has a better set of tools than Mac Jones.
And like most young quarterbacks nowadays, teams expect these guys to play from year one. So a Mac Jones, for instance, if he goes later in the draft and goes to a team where he's not expected to play in the first year, not expected to play much in the first year, you think that really benefits him a lot?
I think that's kind of anecdotal, right? Like, Joe Burrow was ready to go week one. Justin Herbert probably benefited from not playing week one. I think that's kind of up to the individual team, the individual player. I don't know that there's a blanket assessment that you make there. I think there's probably instances in which a QB could really benefit from sitting for a while. Now, you know, the difference this year was, you know, do the Chargers handle things differently if they don't have a capable backup in Tyrod Taylor and if they have a preseason? I'm sure there are teams who view it as our QB can benefit from sitting out for a while, and I'm sure there are prospects, I know there are because we saw one here, that a team goes, you know what, this guy is going to be ready to hit the ground running week one. But who else you have in camp, the nature of your team, who the other quarterbacks are, all those things I think go into that decision. But this isn't like it used to be where I think, you know, often the Carson Palmer model where you sit a guy for a year and you're content to do that. I don't think that's the case anymore. You want to get these guys on the field in year one. I think it's just a matter of, is it going to be like week one or week five? And I don't think there's a – I think that's anecdotal. Some teams it's going to be, yes, we'll play the guy week one. Some players, a team may go, well, you know, this guy's better off sitting a little bit. I don't think there's a blanket way to answer that.
All right. Mo, good talking to you.
It's always good to talk to you, Bob.
All right. See you, man.
All right. See you. Thanks for the phone call. 16 minutes away from 5 o'clock. 513-749-1530 and 866-702-3776. You could hit me up on Twitter, at MoEgger1530. I mentioned this to Jason Fitz. I did not mention this in the bottom of the hour sports update, but in Kansas City, where they're getting ready for the conference championship game, which must be nice. Patrick Mahomes went through a practice today, took the first team snaps. He is still in the concussion protocol, but that is a step in the right direction. But there is something looming over all of that, that if you're a Bengals fan, you want, I know I do, we'll tell you what that is coming up in 20 minutes on ESPN 1530 Cincinnati Sports Station. All right, 12 from 5, this is ESPN 1530. Website is at ESPN1530.com/Mo. At MoEgger1530 is how you can hit me up on the Twitter, on the internet. So do that. And our phone number is 513-749-1530 and 866-702-3776. Let's see here. Mark is calling from NoKY, Northern Kentucky. Hi, Mark. What's up?
What's up, Mo? How you doing, man?
I'm well. What's going on?
Good. Hey, I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about the salary cap and the numbers that I found. If that makes sense, what we can do on the off season. So I was like looking at numbers online, and I think we're gonna have like a salary cap of like $34 million, mm-hmm. right around that.
Available to spend right now, $34-35 million.
Yeah. And then I saw a tweet from Ben Baby that we might have an excess of $10 million. So maybe that gives us like 34, 44, around that area. And then I was kind of looking what we could do. I love Atkins, but if we cut Geno, that would, you know, save us like around maybe $9 million,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And if we cut Bobby Hart, I think that'll save us around like $6 to $7
million, mm-hmm.
which will allow us to be aggressive in the free agency to get like maybe two of the top tier offensive linemen, you know, maybe like a Joe Thuney or Moton or maybe even Trent Williams. And I was seeing if what your take would that be, if that's even realistic to maybe like dream of at night.
Well, what I would want to know is, number one, you know, you talk about where they are cap wise. So they're sitting there right about $34-35 million, right? Geno Atkins would get them to a place where now you make it about $44 million if you cut him. Then Bobby Hart, we assume he's gone. That's about $6 million. So now we're talking about $50 million. You can keep going, by the way. You could, you know, theoretically, you could cut Giovanni Bernard. That's $4 million. You could cut CJ Uzama. That's another $4-5 million. So now we're approaching like $59-60 million. You can keep doing the accounting and create a big number. I guess what I would want to know is, A, how much competition are they going to have? Every team in the NFL wants offensive linemen. Every team in the NFL. No, but I don't think there's a team in the NFL that looks at its offensive line in a given year and is like, you know what? We're good. We don't need to touch it. You'll do that at quarterback. You'll do that at maybe a handful of other positions. There's not a team in the NFL that isn't going to address its offensive line, whether it's looking at free agents in the draft. Heck, when the Bengals were really good from 2011 through 2015, in 2015 they still took offensive linemen in the first two rounds. So what I would want to know in terms of free agency is how much competition is there for those offensive linemen, and then how many of those teams can afford it? Salary cap is going to come down around the NFL. How many of those teams do you scrape off the plate and go, okay, they're not major players? All right, so let's say there's 10 teams interested in Joe Thuney. How many can really afford him? Maybe you knock off a couple of teams, and then it's, you know, 7 to 8 teams. How much then do you have to overpay? How much do you have to pay higher than market value? Then what does that do in terms of affecting your ability to make the rest of your team better? What does that do to your ability to sign another offensive lineman? That's what I would want to know. And then number two is, does the player actually want to come here? Tooney's obviously from the Dayton area, so perhaps there's a pull here. But if he's that good, and we're talking about a guy who's been a foundational piece of championship teams, the Cincinnati Bengals are not going to be the only team interested. So how many teams want him, and then how many teams can realistically afford him? The Bengals probably can, but then even if they can, does the player want to come here? And I can apply that. I can apply that to Moton. I can apply that to a couple of different guys. But they do have money to spend on the offensive line.
It sounds like we're just going to have to overpay these veterans offensive linemen for them to even like be enticed by coming to Cincinnati.
But who would be opposed to that, right? Like, you can't overpay to keep Joe Burrow healthy. You can't pay.
Yeah.
There's no such thing as paying too much to keep Joe Burrow healthy.
Exactly. I had one more question for you. How much do you think Carl Lawson is worth? How much do you think we can do to re-sign him? Because I've been getting kind of anxious about that.
Yeah, I feel like they can. In terms of exactly what kind of money he would get, the Bengals have done a very good job of giving their best players fair deals. I'm going to assume that Carl Lawson is offered something very, very fair. He may just want to pursue the open market. He may not want to sign a contract extension, but they have done a very good job of keeping their best players at fair market contracts, and I think they're going to do the same with Carl Lawson.
Okay, sweet. Yeah, that would feel good coming to the offseason. Free agency doesn't start till like March 17th, right? Like we
in
can't
that
start.
Range. Yeah, correct.
Okay, all right, cool. All right, man, well, I appreciate you having me on and answering my questions. I love hearing you and Tony, man.
Oh,
you guys
thanks.
Make my more.
We have a lot of fun together. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. See you, man.
All right. Thank you. You know, I mean, nobody wants to to hear this. They have a great track record of keeping their best guys. Throw all the other gripes and issues and problems you have with the Bengals and criticisms, and many of them are very, very fair. But if we were to draw, if we were to take a piece of paper and draw a line down the middle of it, and on the left-hand side of it, really good players that stayed here because they got fair deals, and really good players that they didn't offer a deal to and got away, on the left-hand side, the list of guys who stayed here because they got really good contracts drastically outweighs the other column. You could argue they've been too loyal to some of these guys. We just spent a season wondering, what would this team be like if they hadn't given deals to Carlos Dunlap and Geno Atkins? You can make the argument they held on to A.J. Green too long. They had two guys on this year's team, and Geno and A.J., who for a brief amount of time were the highest paid at their positions. There's a very good track record here of keeping their absolute best guys. Hell, they just did it again with Joe Mixon. Controversial thing because he's a running back, but they did it with Joe Mixon. There's a lengthy list of those guys. Now, did some other players get away? Yeah, look, Andrew Whitworth did. Andrew Whitworth defied the odds. The Bengals made a wager that an aging tackle wasn't going to keep playing at the level that he has. And Andrew Whitworth proved them wrong. Andrew Whitworth defied. The Bengals played the odds. They really did. I don't like that they did it. I think they should have been willing to roll the dice with a guy who was playing at that level to keep their offensive line intact. But they played the odds. But even before then, Andrew Whitworth got multiple contracts after his first one with this team. And they paid him very, very handsomely. Complimentary players have gotten away. Mohamed Sanu's a complimentary player, good complimentary player. Marvin Jones wanted to be paid like a number one wide receiver. Bengals already had a number one wide receiver. They weren't going to pay a complimentary guy. But for the most part, their best guys they've kept. Carl Lawson's one of their best guys. Jesse Bates is, I would argue, their best defensive player. So they have typically figured out a way. They've also entered this new realm. And I am admittedly not the best. I'm not the best at anything, but admittedly not the absolute best when it comes to manipulating salary cap numbers and doing the math with all that. But you can really create some space quite easily. This team has done that in recent years. They've been willing to move on from guys who had time left on their contracts. Go back to the offseason in which they moved on from George Iloka and Brandon LaFell. They moved on from Dre Kirkpatrick last year. You could take Geno Atkins and you could take Bobby Hart very, very easily and save a huge chunk of money, an enormous chunk of money. So, you know, their track record has typically, they get deals done with their best incumbent players. Now the problem is you got to figure out a way to lure players from the outside. And, I, you know, we make it sound simple. Well, just go get an offensive lineman. Go pay an offensive lineman. There's going to be a lot of competition. Has there ever been a time, regardless of what team you root for, has there ever been a time in which you thought, you know what, we don't need offensive linemen. We're good here. We don't need to go get some. I mean, like, are you ever, like, so enamored with every offensive lineman you have for the short and long term that you're not willing to address it? There's not a team in the league that couldn't use help at that position group. Bengals are in a unique spot because they need multiple guys, and their quarterback suffered an injury this past season that ended his year behind a crappy offensive line, which heightens the urgency to make that group better. But there's going to be a lot of competition. Competition creates a bidding war. Bidding war drives up prices. If you're going to want to get one of those guys, you're going to have to overpay. Now, is that going to throw off your cap situation to the extent that there are other guys you can't keep? Maybe. And if the answer is yes, then you look at the $48 million they just gave a running back. A couple away from 5 o'clock, 513-749-1530, 866-702-3776. We spent a lot of time late in the season harping on Zach Taylor. This weekend, is an illustration as to why. We'll get to that next on ESPN 1530 Cincinnati Sports Station.
Are you ready for some football?
Hi, this is Dan Hoare. Join Dave Lapham and me for every play of every game on the official home of the Bengals, ESPN 1530.
There you go. There you go. There you go. It's 25 away from 5:30. Huh? 5 after 5, ESPN 1530. The roundabout way of me saying we're done at 5:30. Done in 25 minutes. UK basketball, Wildcats, Georgia. Kentucky trying to break a two-game losing skid. Tip off at 7 pregame at 5:30 right here on ESPN 1530. Looking forward to that. Fun right now to just watch any college basketball game. No Bearcats tomorrow. No Bearcats on Saturday. Xavier was scheduled to play on Tuesday. Now that's not going to happen. And, you know, to a degree, you feel, I mean... When you say this, you don't mean to minimize people who are going through real-world problems when it comes to the pandemic, which has touched, you know, every person in this country, whether it's economically, whether it's from a health and safety standpoint. But you get the sense that being a college basketball player right now is not fun. And, you know, that's you still get a chance to go to college for free and you get to play college basketball. You know, all that stuff is – it just – you get the sense, maybe for me, and I can't even really explain why, but a little bit more so than in college football, you just get the sense the experience is leaving a lot to be desired for these guys. And you just, the coaches navigating this, coaching all the time, going through every day, there's nothing worse than going through everyday life, looking over your shoulder. And if you're a college basketball coach, and I would certainly apply this to a lot of other college sports programs, continually looking over your shoulder. What's next? What's our next positive test? What's our next postponement? What's the next thing we're going to have to deal with? It's the next obstacle. It's the next time we're going to be able to practice. It's the next game that's going to be taken away. That can't be easy. But nonetheless, we do have a game tonight, Kentucky and Georgia, live on ESPN 1530. The conference championship games are this weekend in the NFL. And here's the good news. And I say this independent of any sort of rooting interest. I'm probably going to bet on Kansas City, but Patrick Mahomes practiced today. And things are looking better in terms of the outlook for him playing on Sunday. He is not out of the concussion protocol yet, but he's taking some really, really good steps. That's great. It's good for the product. It's good for the NFL. It's good for the game. It's better when you have the best available players. It's more fun. It's more interesting. You got a better chance of it being a better game when the best players are on the field. But, you know, we spent a lot of time this year talking about Zach Taylor, which is kind of the byproduct of a team that's not very good, and the Bengals weren't this year. And you know, I would say this for years about quarterbacks. When we were in the middle of all those discussions about Andy Dalton, should the Bengals give him a contract extension? How much should it be worth? Do you move in another direction? What do you do? And I would often say, you know, the Dalton thing for me, franchise quarterbacks, regardless of what you pay them, franchise quarterbacks, to me, they always give you a puncher's chance. They always give you a shot, right? And they're going to be this constant amid this sea of change. Sometimes your offensive line is not going to be very good. Franchise quarterback still keeps you in the hunt. Sometimes you're going to have injuries to your skill guys. Franchise quarterback keeps you in the mix. Sometimes your defense is not going to be that good. I think the remarkable thing about Tom Brady, and I know there's a lot of people who decided long ago they don't like Tom Brady, but the remarkable thing about him to me is I've watched him have success on a number of different type of teams. There were times in New England where they had no running game whatsoever. There were times in New England where they had substandard wide receivers. There were times in New England where they spent no money on defense. There were times in New England where the team itself wasn't that good. And yet Tom Brady constantly had him in the playoffs, constantly had him in the conference championship game, and constantly had him in the Super Bowl where they won six of them. That's a franchise quarterback. Now, that is the greatest of all time as far as I'm concerned, but that's what you're looking for. Somebody who, no matter what, gives you a chance. Gives you a chance the next game, gives you a chance the next season. Said that earlier this week about Drew Brees. New Orleans Saints have just enjoyed a decade and a half plus of almost nonstop relevance. They didn't win enough, quite frankly, given the stature of the quarterback that Drew Brees has become. But every single week, you feared him. And every single week, if you're a Saints fan, you felt like this coach, this quarterback gives us a chance. I believe the Bengals have that with Joe Burrow. I watched in the first half of the year this year. Team wasn't very good. They were in every game but one that he started in the first half of the year. Without a preseason, without a regular training camp, first half of the year, they were in every game but one. To me, that is more of a statement about Joe Burrow than anybody else. And I believe moving forward, if they could just make the team a little bit better, every single week, Joe Burrow is going to make you feel like you've got a shot, sometimes less so than others. Every single year, Joe Burrow is going to make you feel like the Bengals have a shot. Which means one of the two goals that I wanted the Bengals to accomplish in 2020, they actually did, as frustrating as this year was. I walked away from this season feeling like they've got their QB. But the other thing I wanted to know was, do they have their coach? So there still is a chance that the Kansas City Chiefs are going to have to play the AFC Championship game with Chad Henne as their starting quarterback. Perhaps less of a chance of that happening today than there might have been yesterday, but still, that possibility exists. Now, we had a guy call the show yesterday who says he thinks that Chad Henne is better than Andy Dalton, which is a ridiculous statement. It is. There's no metric by which you would say Chad Henne is better than Andy Dalton. He is a backup. He's had no success as a starting quarterback in this league. He has never started a playoff game. And yes, he completed the pass on 4th-and-1 on Sunday. He also entered the game with the Kansas City Chiefs leading the game. At one point, they were up 19-3. He was in a position where he basically had to not screw it up. And he did what you want a backup quarterback to do. He didn't screw it up. And when he was asked to make a play, he did. Let's not pretend it was the highest percentage throw on 4th-and-1 to wrap up the game. But good for him for making it. But if Chad Henne had to play this Sunday, if you're a fan of the Kansas City Chiefs, certainly helps that you have a hell of a roster. Certainly helps that you have a tight end who's going to be in the Hall of Fame one day. Certainly helps that you have a group of wide receivers that can just streak down the field and do all sorts of things. It helps that you've got a level of competence at running back that you can rely on. More than anything for me, helps that you have great coaching. Andy Reid's far from infallible. There have been a number of times, especially in the postseason, where I've watched his clock management in the playoffs, and I think it's come back to hurt his team. So a few years ago, Kansas City, New England in the postseason, they're taking their sweet time down by 10 points, and it's like, Andy, how about some urgency here? It was ridiculous. He saw it in a Super Bowl between the Eagles and Patriots when Andy Reid was coaching Philadelphia. Clock management and Andy Reid have long been a problem. But what's not a problem, preparedness, schematics, development and work with quarterbacks, having his team ready to play. By the way, Andy Reid before Patrick Mahomes had never coached a Hall of Fame caliber QB. Donovan McNabb was very, very good for a number of years. Sorry, Taryn, Donovan McNabb ain't in Canton, my man. Won a lot of games with Alex Smith. If you're a Kansas City Chiefs fan, and you're told Patrick Mahomes is being taken away, you feel like, you know what? We got a shot. Our coach is going to put the team in a position to win. Our coach is going to coach to whatever strengths the backup quarterback has. Our coach is going to figure out a way for us to at least stay afloat to be in the game late. Our coach is going to come up with something. Coach is going to have a degree of preparedness. Coach is going to have us in a position to win the game despite not having one of the best players in the entire sport. Holy crap, that matters. That's what I'm looking for from Zach Taylor. Tony Pike and I always talk about, do you have any sort of tactical advantage over some of the other coaches in this division? Mike Tomlin, for all the criticism he got, Mike Tomlin and John Harbaugh are both coaches who have won an extraordinary amount of games. They're both probably going to get a Canton one day themselves. You could say what you want. Mike Tomlin schematically, maybe not so much. But, you know, from a motivational standpoint, it's certainly there. Those are two well-run organizations. We've long talked about having any kind of advantage on the sideline. What I want more than anything, though, is I want to be able to say, you know what? Zach Taylor is going to give him a chance. Now, there's a long, 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 long gap between where Zach is in his NFL career and where Andy Reid is. He's taken multiple franchises to Super Bowls. He's coached in a billion conference championship games. He has put together a Hall of Fame resume, and he's got a guy in Eric Bieniemy working just beneath him that a lot of people think should be given a chance to be a head coach in the National Football League. And the fact that he's on a team that's going to be in the Super Bowl possibly has worked against him now back-to-back years because teams don't want to wait until after the Super Bowl the way the Bengals did, which is just ridiculous. But if you're a Kansas City Chiefs fan, and even as somebody who's not, just looking at those games on Sunday, there's a lot of coaches in this league. It certainly helps that you have a good roster. And the fact that they're in this game certainly says something about the coaching they have. But I'm just looking for something to make me go, you know what? Despite what you don't have, this coach gives them a chance. And by the way, it certainly plays in Zach's favor that when they played the Steelers late in the year with Ryan Finley, they won the game. Not a very good Pittsburgh team at the end of the year because everybody was beating them, but still, they won the game. And with Brandon Allen against the Texans. Say what you want about that Texans defense, which was historically bad. Brandon Allen, short on experience, he played really well that day. Those things are credits to the coaching staff. What I'd like to do one day, though, is be in a position where if the starting quarterback can't go for whatever reason, which hopefully doesn't happen, but at some point I'm betting will, you go, you know what? That coach gives us a chance. That coach can still put this team in a position to win. That coach can still take the backup quarterback and have him ready and coach to his strengths. And that's where I want to be with Zach Taylor. That, to me, is when you know you've got your coach. 17 after 5. 513-749-1530, 866-702-3776. Mo at ESPN1530.com is the email address. It's 17 after 5, UK basketball coming up in 13 minutes. Your phone calls are welcome. This is ESPN 1530, Cincinnati Sports Station. 20 minutes after 5, this is ESPN 1530. My name's Mo Egger. I am thrilled that you're here. Kentucky basketball coming up in 10 minutes. The Wildcats taking on Georgia. If you missed it from earlier today, another postponement for both UC and Xavier. The Bearcats are now not playing on Saturday against Houston, and Xavier's next game next week against Georgetown also not happening. No makeup dates for either announced, but postponements continue for both those programs, and they are far from alone. 21 after 5, 513-749-1530. Mike is on ESPN 1530. Hello, Mike.
Hey, Mo. Thanks for having me on. Listen to you all the time.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
I just had a couple thoughts that I wanted to hear your about the Reds. One is I've heard over the last couple of weeks that you've said that the bullpen is a lot worse with losing Raisel Iglesias. And
that's not as good. I don't know if it's a lot worse, but it's not as good.
Yeah. Yes, but so I did some research, and he went three. So he was 7-15 over the last 2 years with also 10 blown saves and an ERA of 4. Mm-hmm. So my thought is just I'm glad that he's gone because, in my opinion, really 2 years ago, he really cost the Reds getting into the postseason with that bad of a record, as especially with us using him as a closer as much as he has. And
two years ago when they lost 87 games, the reason why they didn't get to the postseason was Raisel Iglesias?
Well, that and also the 1-8 start didn't help things, but right. I really think if we had a bona fide closer, then we really could have done something good that year.
Yeah.
And also, I saw today that the Reds are in talks with the Mets to get rid of Suarez and Gray, and I just wanted to hear your thoughts about that.
So, first of all, on Raisel Iglesias, over his last 20 outings last year, his ERA was 1.71. He struck out 27 batters in 21 innings. And basically from, if you remember, they played Detroit the first week of the year, and he had a couple of bad outings. He loses a game. It was that first Saturday of the season where they had a 3-1 lead. Stevenson coughs it up in the seventh, and Iglesias loses the game in the ninth inning. His second outing, he also gave up a couple of runs. From that point forward, he had like one bad outing. It was a save that he blew in St. Louis, and he came back the next night and he retired the side in order with a strikeout. From his third outing of the year until the end of the season, he gave up four earned runs. He walked five guys in 21 innings. He was dominant at times. Opposing hitters hit 155 against him. He was fantastic. Now, the year before, 2019, he was fine in save situations. In fact, that was the big thing, if you remember. It wasn't when he was asked to get a save. It was when he was pitching in non-save situations.
Correct.
And so, you know, that to me was a usage issue. It was a more of a Raisel Iglesias issue than anything. He still led the league in games finished that season. He didn't have a great year. We're still talking about a guy who in four of his six full seasons has had an ERA under three, who's not a guy who gives up an insane amount of home runs. Last year, Raisel Iglesias gave up one home run, albeit an abbreviated season. 22 outings, he gave up one home run. If you don't think he should close, that's fine. There's discussions. It should have been maybe Archie Bradley or Amir Garrett or Michael Lorenz. That's fine. But that dude had a great arm. He is in his prime, and you've replaced him with nobody comparable. That is an issue.
Yeah, his arm is great. That was never the issue. It was him with the home run, like especially in 2019, just and pitching in Great American Ballpark. With the amount of home runs he gave up then, but yes, correct.
So he had a bad year in 2019. Fine, he rebounded with a really good year this year. And again, if you want to say get rid of Raisel Iglesias because he's not a good fit at GABP, fine. You got to replace him with somebody, and the Reds have not. Now, trading away Sonny Gray and Eugenio Suarez, I guess what I would want to know is what are you going to get that is of similar value that could help you win this year? Are you just dumping salary? If you're just dumping salary, That to me limits what you're going to get in return. And with Eugenio Suarez specifically, if you're going to trade him, isn't that the quintessential selling low because he had a bad year last year? Isn't the idea to sell high and get as much return as possible? And if you're going to trade away Sonny Gray and you're already about to lose the best pitcher in the National League, how can you reasonably tell people that you're going to contend when the biggest strength of your team from last year, you've now said goodbye to three starters if you include Anthony DeSclafani? That doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't. They either need to be ready to win this year or tell everyone that they're rebuilding. It can't be either or.
Yeah, you got to go in one direction or the other. And you just articulated my biggest frustration. I think this team has a shot to be pretty good. If you told me, look, you can trade away all these bad contracts and we're going to start from scratch, I wouldn't like it. But okay, you're at least going in a definitive direction. Since you can't do that, then take what you have and add to it and worry about the finances later. I know that's a really easy thing for me to say. It's not the most nuanced way to put it. But from a pure baseball perspective, it just sort of feels like they're hoping that they emerge as the least bad of all these bad teams in the division, and that's pretty uninspiring.
Yes, it is. Thanks, Mo.
Mike, I enjoyed it, man. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, look, you know, Raisel Iglesias 2 years ago was not good at all. but if you recall, we spent the entire year having this conversation about, well, do you bring him in non-save situations? And people complained about, you know, well, you can't bring him in non-save situations. And I'm like, well, then you get rid of him because that's not how we use relief pitchers anymore. And David Bell was very upfront before the 2019 season with Raisel Iglesias about how he was going to be used. But he did bounce back in 2020, and he had a really good year. He wasn't perfect, and I think in large part because of the length of the season, when you blow a save and every game matters as much as every game did this year, especially in a season where it felt like the Reds were swimming upstream all year long, the failures get magnified. But if you watched him game in and game out last year, he was outstanding. He had the game, the second game of the year, which they led 3-1. He comes in the ninth inning. He's trying to hold on to a 3-3 game. He gives up a home run. The following week, he gave up a couple of runs. I think he came in the eighth inning in a game the Reds were already losing. He got dinged then. From that point forward, his next five outings, dominant. Struck out multiple batters in each of them. Three of those outings, he went more than just one inning.
Then on August the 20th, he pitches against the Cardinals. That was a game that the Reds blow. He blows the save, couldn't throw a strike, couldn't get anybody out. Bad outing. He had a 4-2 lead. They lose 5-4. They get walked off. His ERA at that point was 7.71. That was his seventh outing of the season. From that point forward to the end of the regular season, Raisel Iglesias pitched 16 innings, gave up one earned run. He struck out 18. His ERA was 0.56. Opposing hitters batted 167. Opposing batters had an OPS of 4.06. There's other deeper, more nuanced numbers that I can give you, but I think you get the point. From that point forward, he was great. He was a reason why this team got to the postseason. He absolutely was a reason why this team got to the postseason. The Reds just traded him away for Noe Ramirez. And look, by the way, in the postseason, in Game 2 against Atlanta, he melted down. That game was over by the time he came in, and they didn't hit. Raisel Iglesias is an asset. He's a guy you keep if you're trying to win the division and trying to get to the postseason. And if you don't let Archie Bradley get away for nothing. And the Reds did both those things. We have to go. UK basketball is next. Back at it 3:05 tomorrow. Have a great night. This is ESPN 1530, Cincinnati Sports Station.